Hi, and welcome to Be Indie Now, a podcast for independent game development. I'm your host, Tobias Marks. With me today is Stefan Sherrigan, UI designer at SoundHound.
Thank you.
And Brody Brooks, a game designer at WayForward.
Thanks for having me.
So today I wanted to talk about UX and UI, and specifically, how do you create a good UI, UX? I mean, those two terms are different. One is UX for user experience, and one is UI for user interface. They're kind of thrown about together all the time, and some people don't really know the difference between them. So, Stefan, as a professional UI, UX designer, what is the difference?
Well, UI is basically where you design the buttons, you make sure everything looks pretty, and you try to find some kind of consistency within your app and follow it, and the general platform consistency, you know, like using Microsoft icons on Microsoft apps and using Android on Android and things like that. Colors, a lot of UI paradigms are derived directly from the graphic design principles. With UX, it's kind of a lesser known other half of UI. It's kind of where you go through the wireframes of your designs before you go into the high resolution comps, where you go through the flow of your UI, like what is your user able to do on each page of your app, and how do they get through the app? What's the first time experience? What's the kind of type of navigation that takes place throughout the app as they're continuing to use the app, and what are the kind of unique features within the page, like sliding controls or panels that open up, things like that, and perhaps they are patterns that are consistent with that platform, perhaps there's something really new and unique, but that's really where the line between UI and UX is different, and it's important to make use of both. In many companies, there are separate UI and UX designers. Sometimes there are people like me who do both, and even if you're a developer, you need to make sure to kind of study up on those things and take them into account and utilize as many of those things as you can, because they will make your app much better.
Yeah, it's not just you can put, you know, pretty buttons and have nice curves and corners, but having that design philosophy behind it, knowing how the user is going to interact with your app, what buttons they'll need to press in order to get to which areas, that's where the user experience comes in. And this is particularly important in games. I mean, I guess it's important in all apps and all software, but games, it's directly about the user experience, and they want to keep having fun at all times. So a lot of it, when I hear about UX design in games, a lot of it is really about maintaining that fun. Brody, what would you say the relationship between fun and UX is when you're making games?
Well, so when you're designing a game, basically what a game is doing is it's like any other application, but it's going at a very rapid pace where the user receives some sort of input from the game, kind of thinks about it, puts something, and then puts another input into the computer. And so you kind of have this rapid conversation going on between the computer and the player. And so what a really good user interface or user experience is the player, when the player puts an input into the computer, like whatever they were thinking that they wanted to do is what actually happens. And so that's part of why, like, you know, there's a lot of debate on different control schemes and how computer games, there's a lot of different like configurable controls, because people get crazy about, like, you know, how do I prefer to talk to the computer and talk to the games? And, you know, because you want to have as much accuracy between what the player is thinking and what actually happens in the game.
Yeah, so that minor interface lag. I know in Game Feel by Steve Swink, he talked a lot about how just that 200 millisecond delay between the action and the result is the complete difference to a game feeling clunky and slow and feeling sharp and smooth, like you're really connected to the player as you move around. And so you have to think about that outside a perspective of not just this button does this, but how it responds to it in what way. Maybe putting an acceleration on it when you're running instead of going from, you know, zero speed to 60 speed and you're just, you know, running around, to have it slowly ramp up as you start moving. And that little bit of momentum that wouldn't really affect gameplay, but it makes it feel a bit more solid, has a bit more connection to real world, like there's a bit more weight to the player, and that changes the experience.
Well, I'd argue that game feel has everything to do with user interface and user experience, and it affects it greatly. But you know, when I'm talking about what the player puts into the game and what happens, I'm not just talking about input lag. I'm talking about like the player having an assumption of what they're doing and something else happens entirely. Like, okay. I press forward, or what I think is forward, and then the player fires a gun.
Well, in that sense, actually, user interface is exactly that. It's your user interfacing with your application, whether it's software or whether it's a game, right? And what I kind of like to refer to it is the incidence of error. So assume that anytime you don't design something, or you do design something poorly, that they're not going to be able to interface, meaning they're not going to understand what they're looking at and how it responds. Or they're going to think or make assumptions, right? Because the human mind is actually really liable to look at any system, break it down, oftentimes incorrectly, and make the wrong assumptions based on that. Then when they act on their assumptions by interacting with an interface they have now optically recognized, they get the result they don't expect. Then that leads to frustration. That leads to kind of this knock-up effect of, you know, I've done several actions now, and they've resulted in negative experiences. And kind of the more you fill that bag of negative experiences, the more your app is failing. And the more your app is failing, then the more they want to go do something else, you know?
Yeah, it's friction points, right? You want to, every time the user doesn't like what they're experiencing, every time they have that any reason at all to want to leave your app or your game, especially if we're talking in the casual games and the social game space, your game is lost. I mean, casual and social, you know, their app is probably majority based on the UX over everything. I mean, when you get into the core game space, I've seen core games that maybe their UX is bad. You know, I've played Final Fantasy games. Would you say Final Fantasy has a good UX? I'd make a lot of arguments that it doesn't in some ways, but yet that game is incredibly fun to play. That game's incredibly good, but there's these things in the interface where it behaves weirdly. It's kind of archaic. You have to know where to go in that menu to press this button. It's this language that is, you know, players of the Final Fantasy are used to, but someone who's outside of it might have a harder time getting in.
Well, you know, there's Final Fantasy XII that I played, and that was actually a really fun game because it left the entire paradigm of, like, I'm walking through the grass, random monster encounter, I'm walking through the grass again, random monster encounter, right? It actually had a real-time system where you would encounter an enemy, you get that lead to the enemy, mm-hmm. that tell you you're attacking it, you'd actually fight them in real time, and you actually then proceed, like, down the tunnel. And that allowed me to actually enjoy Final Fantasy because it kind of broke out of its usual UI, UX.
That classic Pokemon, well, I guess Pokemon didn't invent that formula, but that random battle system. What was that, like Dragon Warrior, I guess, would have been one of the first that did that? I'm not familiar enough with the history
Pokemon
of games.
And I know the grunge of, like...
Yeah, that Japanese RPG style. I mean, it's kind of easy to pick on Japanese RPG just because it's a language of games that I'm not used to. And speaking of UX, that it really is a language of how you're used to communicating. Like Brody was saying, you know, I'm not used to that JRPG game style, so I don't know the conventions there, right? It's the same way a first-person shooter, if it uses anything besides WASD on the keyboard to move around, people are going to have a really hard time playing it. Not that, you know, ESDF is that much harder to use, but it kind of goes against that convention. It goes against what the user expects to happen, and it will hamper their experience.
Well, while we're on the subject of Final Fantasy, I recently joined WayForward as a designer, and I consider myself, like, I play a lot of games, I keep up with the lingo, I follow a lot of developers, and but when I came to WayForward, everyone's super, super into very old games, like games from the 80s and 90s, and And so there was a lot of games I hadn't actually played that seemed to be in like the common parlance. So for example, like Final Fantasy VII was a game that, you know, everyone talks about. Everyone's like, this is a shining example of where RPGs and gameplay and story all kind of came to a new step up. And so, you know, finally, like, everyone was like, oh, you haven't played that? You really should. So I said, okay, well, it's available on the PlayStation 3. I'll just buy it, play it, and I'll actually finish it, because I've never actually finished a Final Fantasy. And I found it very difficult to keep myself going for a lot of very, you know, what are very, things they decided to do back then that were very much, like, design philosophies and user interface philosophies that just you don't really do anymore. And so, like, one thing that really stopped me from playing the game was how, so in Final Fantasy VII, they try to do this really cool thing where you have all these, like, nicely intricate 3D environments and all these polygonal characters walking around. And, the problem that presented, that they probably didn't realize while they were developing it, was that these environments, they're all pre-rendered. It's really just a 2D image, but it's pre-rendered. And you're walking around, and there's not a clear indicator of what you can walk over and what you can't. What's considered a wall and what's considered like a ramp or a wall or, you know, a pathway. Like, that's all, like, you know, that's all up to the artists to try to communicate that.
Is that an issue and of so, design, though, Brody, or is that more of the technology at the time when that came out?
Well, both, because they decided to go in this direction, it created a very poor user experience. Because I would try to walk around someplace, try to get up this ramp that I, you know, try to progress through the game, but another tenet of Final Fantasy design is that there's all these random battles, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm walking around a dangerous area, then at any moment I can get into a battle, and it'll be like a 2 to 3 minute experience. And so I'm trying to navigate through this environment, and, you know, because, like, oh, that's actually not a traversable area, and whoops, I got into a random battle, and I've got to be very, very frustrating. Because the game wasn't communicating to me very clearly, like, where can I go? What can I do? You know, what can't I do? And so I ended up dropping the game for very poor experience.
That's actually a really good example that you put out there, Brody, that as developers, you really got to think about the user experience, and the way that you can get through that is by user testing. I mean, oftentimes, you're in there, you're making the app, right, and you've been doing it for weeks or months, and you don't see, like, what the initial kind of pitfalls or hidden traps are that users are going to experience when they actually interact with the game. So you can have your friends play it, have your family play it, go to a coffee shop, buy people free coffee, have them play it. You're going to get a ton of feedback and results. Watch them over the shoulder, take plenty of notes, go back and actually act on those. If you do put out the app and you get reviews or feedbacks or comments, take that into account. Put it into some kind of system, a spreadsheet, or any kind of management tracking, and then go through that list and go and do it. Your app will improve fantastically if you just avoid those, you know, very basic pitfalls that you can't see because you're not an objective viewer. You're someone who's been in the trenches building it.
Yeah, I mean, I would even argue just like your friends can't even play test for it. You have to go out there and get strangers. You have to get people you've never met before. You have to get people who've never played the kind of app or played the kind of game you make or use the kind of app that you're developing before and see what their experience is like. Get that fresh user. Go out to a farmer's market. Go somewhere. Go in a public place and buy a Little Caesar's pizza. Put it out there. Say, free slice of pizza if you play test my app. It's the best way you're going to get feedback. And user experience is definitely one of those things that it's about the user's experience. So you have to go out there and get feedback. You can read all these books. You can give it as many designers as you want to critique it. But at the end of the day, it's your users who have to shape your game or your potential users, how you want it to feel for them.
that's the important thing.
Yeah,
right?
getting feedback from you know as many sources as possible is very important, because when you're designing menus and you're designing an interface and how the thing is going to work, it makes sense to you, but maybe it doesn't make sense to other people. Like as an example, Gasketball. There's a team of people called Mike and Greg that made a game called Gasketball, and it was a very polished game. They spent 2 years on it, and it was a freemium game, so you can download it, and if you really liked it, then you can go and pay $2.99 to get the app. But they didn't do proper testing on the interface to know that people wouldn't be able to find that buy button, because that buy button was down and like buried in two layers of menu. And so they end up losing a lot of money on that game because they didn't properly test their user interface and how people were interacting with the app.
Yeah, they made some assumptions because, oh, well, obviously people will click through these menus, or if they wanted to find this. And most users didn't even know there was an in-app purchase, let alone actually chose to buy it. So you have to make it. I mean, that goes into just your marketing. You want to make your in-app purchases and your monetization present within your app. So you want to make all what makes your app fun, what makes it unique, what makes your game special. You want to make it present within your app. In addition to your monetization and everything else, you want the user to know about or interact with. And if your UseX is just so buried or so clunky or so many features just bogging it down that people can get lost, that's not going to be as good of a game as it could be.
Not only that, but you want to let go of your work. And what I mean by that is when you're designing something and you're absolutely in love with it and you think it's absolutely the right thing, right? But it turns out to be absolutely the wrong thing from either feedback, or you realize through thinking through the user's shoes, like, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't work or this doesn't work. You have to be able to deconstruct it, sometimes almost completely, and start from scratch. Because many programmers have this problem. Many designers have this problem. It's their baby, and they don't want to let it go, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm sure all of us have had games that we love, we're playing, we enjoy them, and then we just know something doesn't work. Like, we show it to people, and they're not figuring it out. And it's just really hard to put exactly what is wrong in the user interface. Like, Brody, when you're making an app and you get it in front of people for the first time, like, and you see that something's wrong, what's your process to think, oh, how do I fix that? Is it obvious based on their feedback that one area is wrong, or is it harder to figure out?
Well, feedback is always kind of a tricky thing to dissect, because someone might say that, oh, this feels very floaty, but it's like, oh, well, what am I going to do about that? What they might say one thing and then they really mean another, and so you kind of have to try to figure out how are they interacting with the app or the game, how is it differing from how you think that it's supposed to be used, and how do you make it more apparent that this is the proper way to use it, or this is what you should be experiencing. Because I'd be very cautious to say that you should do lots and lots of testing and make all your changes based off of feedback. Because at a certain point, you don't want to be slave to that feedback. You want to, as a creator, or at least this is at least relevant for games, not necessarily for applications. But as a game creator, I want to impart something on the player. Like, I want to tell something and I want them to experience something. And if I'm just making something based off of feedback, then I'm not making something, I'm making something for, the mass. I'm trying to make something for, that doesn't say something personal about me.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm programming, I think, when I have an error when I'm programming, sometimes the line of code that's giving me the most trouble is perfectly fine. It's the line above it, or maybe even 10 lines above it, that had an issue, and that's causing a cascading effect. Same thing happens in the user experience. You might have a part of your app that's not working, users are not getting it, it's not making sense to them. It might not be that game mechanic or that UI element is wrong, but there might be some fundamental reason, like actually people would rather just do something different to accomplish the same thing, or some other step where that whole issue could be avoided if this was just integrated into this other menu over here instead of being separated. Stefan, I know, like, in your job, you're dealing with users all the time, the feedback. Like, how do you deal with this, that constant stream? Is it a matter of you're going down those bullet points? Do you categorize them? How do you know which ones to ignore as, okay, well, this issue is actually more of something else, or which one is actually something you should be addressing?
Well, there are definitely major issues that come up. And we try to get to those as soon as possible. For instance, things might not go smoothly on releasing an update. There might be a change in the platform that causes something to break or behave erratically. There are also business considerations. And as we go along, our team does the best job that we can to prioritize some over the others. And of course, we also take in user feedback, and together we sit down and figure out, you know, what's the important thing for the next version. We make a list, and then we divvy up the tasks between designers and programmers, and we start going down that list, you know, and try to ship the best product that we can by release.
How do you deal with feedback globally from people in different countries or different languages? Do you translate the feedback back? Do you, I mean, I don't know if SoundHound is big enough that has teams in different parts of the country for different zones, or how does that work?
Well, we have a separate customer support team, and they deal with direct email and a lot of the online social media and the stores. From what they get, I'm not exactly sure how they deal with non-English speakers. I'm sure they use Google Translate. Funny story, I had a client when I freelanced who spoke English, and only a year into our relationship, found out he doesn't actually speak English. He only speaks fluent German, and he's been using Google Translate this whole time. So I'm sure that...
That's actually really impressive that you could understand it. Yeah.
I'm sure that...
He passed the Turing test the entire time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that... where they can, they use Google Translate. Actually, one of them sent me something the other day that was in Russian, and I had to translate it. And we both figured out what it was that the user wanted and fired him back a reply in his language.
I mean, yeah, it also goes back to having feedback and responding to people is important. But when you're thinking, you know, you have a global app, as your app should be global in a digital distribution world, what kind of UX things are specific to a country? You know, we talk about, like, certain kinds of games have that certain expectations, right? Like the JRPG has the random battles, or first-person shooters, WASD. Different countries have different expectations, too. It might make sense that the next screen flows to the right because we read, you know, left to right. But other countries, they might read completely backwards. So would the app feel backwards once you translate it in that language? Is that something that you even consider or not worry about in your app, Stefan?
Well, with different languages, there are a couple of things. I think the most important one is localization, and the most important in that is how text grows with different weights and sizes and, importantly, lengths. So, like, German is the bane of my existence because it breaks everything. Mm-hmm. You have a button, you think it works, German, right? German happens. So you want to watch out for things like that. You definitely want to watch out for where things are right to left or left to right. If you actually open an Android device and you change its UI to one of the languages, it's inverted, and you go into settings, you'll see that settings has been reversed, and all the icons are put on the other side. And that's to actually make those native speakers feel more at home. Mm-hmm. Something else is colors. Colors mean different things in different places. We think that green is go, red is bad. You know, for us, weddings are white, that's good, but funerals are black. In other countries, it can be different, so you want to be kind of sensitive to that. Although, I haven't personally run into any problems that I can remember regarding that.
It's interesting to consider looking those up. I mean, it's not like there's like a list out there, like, oh, I got to check the, how does this color interpret it in this other place before. It's kind of something about being immersed in that culture to understand those differences.
I think the most important thing is do localize, because if you localize, you're reaching a much larger audience with very little extra work. You're not building a new app for that audience, right? But in order to localize, you got to make sure that you're not baking in your text into your assets or your UI elements, that you're actually having strings and you're having code in there that can change those strings to those different languages, whichever languages those are that you support, and that when you support them, you take into account that the language itself might break your UI and that you design it so that it expands or truncates accordingly to accommodate.
I mean, it's just like also thinking that you want to go cross-platform. You don't want to design your game now just for one specific device. You want to code in such a way that it can be ported to multiple devices. You want to be able to work on, you know, the desktop store and, say, a tablet or phone store or maybe even a console as well. Brody, I know you've designed games meant for controllers, games meant for touch screens, games meant for keyboards. How does the UI design differ from those, or is it kind of ambiguous? Like it or not ambiguous, but it morphs, it changes. It's not that big of a deal for the UX, or is it not? I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, yes. I mean, well, every controller, every interface that you have with computers and tablets all feel very different. So, you know, with the touch screen, you have like precise control over points on the screen, and with controllers, you have very precise control over actions. You can tactically feel like what you're pressing and when. It's precise control in other ways. Keyboards, you have lots of different keys that all have either on and off states. You have to take into account the feel of every controller when you're designing your game. If you're trying to design for multiple platforms, it becomes very difficult to try to translate it between all those different input methods. But on the topic of localizing, so at WayForward, we do a lot of things very spreadsheet based, because we work with publishers. We make games for all different markets, multiple countries, and multiple platforms. And build our games, we always make it so that we can easily translate it into multiple languages. And so we have everything in spreadsheets. So if we have multiple different attacks, we have the name of the attack in English, French, Spanish, Italian, German. And at the beginning, it all just says punch, 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 punch. And then eventually we have the localizers say, okay, what's the Spanish word for punch, or what's the German word for punch? And that's all filled in, and so it's built from the ground up to be localized very, very easily. There's very little overhead when it comes to later saying, oh, well, we need to add more languages. We'll just add more columns to the spreadsheet.
What about the use of symbols? One of my favorite resources is the Noun Project, which is a bunch of collections of vector-based graphics of various nouns. Pizza, skateboard, skull and crossbones, whatever you have up there, you can get a small image that you can use as a button, you can use as a symbol on a door in your game. And what's great about those is they're language universal. So I always advocate making those as much use of those as you can within your apps, because not only are pictures more clear, people like pictures more than reading, but it also becomes more language ambiguous. Do you guys have those symbols, like a punch symbol, and then you don't have to worry about those words being translated, or do you do both just because?
It really depends on the situation. At least from my design philosophy is that if I can use something graphic, if I can show something graphically, then I'll show something graphically. And I try to use language or written word and numbers as little as possible. But sometimes, like, that doesn't make sense. Like, if I'm showing a percentage value, I need to use numbers. If I need to show a health value, sometimes a bar doesn't work. And it's much clearer to just show, like, oh, you have 12 health. But generally we've used icons and symbols more than we've used, strings, because that costs time and money to get localized. Sometimes it's more concise and clear to use an image, and it often leads to a cleaner user interface.
So with icons, it kind of is exactly what you're saying, a case-by-case basis. And for video games, I think icons, especially on consoles and mobile, really help. What you got to watch out for is clarity. Like, if they see the icon, do they understand what it does? Did you provide them a tutorial, you know, if that was necessary to teach them about what it does? Or if they can't figure it out, you know, you might want to switch it out because you're using icon for something that's not platform specific or that's completely opposite of what it's supposed to do, like a play button that stops, you know, or a skull and crossbones for starting a game in a game where that doesn't have a place to be used in that way.
Mm-hmm. No, the symbols have to make sense, and that's part of the visual design. But there's a lot of designers out there, game designers, with developers, you know, they aren't necessarily visual designers, or at least that's a talent that they haven't developed yet. So it can be really hard to make visually a UX or UI experience that looks good or is clear. I mean, can you have a good UI UX in your game with substandard crappy art? Or is it kind of a given that, you know, you need to have really sharp assets? They need to look right. They need to be clear. They need to be identifiable. Do they go hand in hand? Or
nowadays, because of the UI-centric philosophies at some of the major companies, it is imperative to stay competitive and have really great-looking UI and UX. If you don't, unless it's stylized in a very interesting way, all the hard work that's put into it could cause the project to fall through. There have been apps that I installed because they had bad UI or bad icons. There have been apps that were absolutely wonderful for what they were meant to do, but they were overcomplicated. They're kind of like a NASA control center, you know? For certain specialized industries or use cases, it's great, but for the average user, you know, you get overwhelmed, or you get stuck, or it's great, but it looks ugly, right? And those are all things that will get your customers essentially going somewhere else looking for what your app is lacking.
That makes sense.
So, I mean, there's all kinds of different philosophies for user interface as well. So, like, one thing I've really been enjoying lately is there's, like, some game studios have been moving towards minimalist user interface.
Yep.
And so, like, I remember when I first played, or when I first saw footage of Dead Space. And that was made by Visceral Games under Electronic Arts, and the game had no UI. Or rather, it did have UI, but it wasn't covering the screen. It wasn't floating in front of your face.
There wasn't a huge HUD getting in the way.
It was all completely integrated into the environment.
Awesome.
So when you, like, if you wanted to know how much health your character has, well, it's right along the spine, the back of the spine, which is always facing you. And when you wanted to upgrade your weapons, like a little like holographic like display came up in front of your guy. Like, nothing covered the screen at any point.
One of the
and they
things...
also did the same thing in Splinter Cell Conviction, where when they wanted to convey what your objectives were, this is like light projection thing. So they'd like shine a light onto the side of a building, but instead of it being like, you know, like a flashlight, it was words. So it would say like, climb this ladder, or like listen in on the conversation. And it showed you like arrows pointing up the place where you can climb. And that was, and otherwise it just didn't cover the screen at all. And I thought that was so fantastic because, you know, one, like another tenet I have of user interface design is, you know, if something doesn't need to be shown, if it's not important for the player to see at any given point, it's best not to show it. You know, like, is it important to show the score all the time, or does it work well enough that you just show it after the level is over or at a certain checkpoint? Does a player need to see how much ammunition they have, how much health they have, or is that just stuff that, you know, you can show if the player is standing still? Like, it only, like, parts of the user interface only show up when the player isn't doing anything or the player presses a certain button. You know, just stay out of the player's way, and if he needs to know something, then show it.
I actually found that true in GTA 5. So in GTA 4, you have the heart and everything else, and you have the numbers there. But in GTA 5, I first went in, and I couldn't find where they moved it. And it turns out that next to the map, you have the little bars. You have like a green bar. Yeah,
it wraps
bar,
around the map now.
And something else. And I found that to be actually much better because I don't have these giant numbers floating when I don't care about them, right? I take a glance when I need to and it's there, and when I don't, it's not. So, yeah, absolutely. Immerse your gamer if you can. Think about each screen and what absolutely needs to be there, what's core to the function of that screen, and think about moving everything else off.
Yeah, I only show what's necessary, definitely. Well, that was an excellent discussion, guys. I want to talk about like what games we've been playing lately. I like to do every show episode. For myself, this week I have been super, super busy, but I still managed to squeeze in some time to play the new Pokemon. I'm really liking it. They've changed a lot about it. Speaking of how older game designs, that JRPG style has been kind of set in its ways. The new Pokemon's finally changed some of those elements, added some new gameplay mechanics where you have the one versus many battles. They streamlined some of the things like TMs. It used to be a one-use thing, and now you can use them as much as you want, and that just makes it a much easier game experience, and it makes it a little bit easier, but they finally made those changes to improve my experience enjoying that game. I also have been playing The Last of Us. I've been going through it really, really slowly, just like a couple hours at a time. I'm enjoying it so far, but I'm like halfway through it, so I don't want to talk much about it because I know other cool stuff will happen at some point. But so far, so good. I'm going to hold any review comments I make till after I finish it. What have you been playing, Stefan?
Well, when I was sick, I started Quake 1. I pulled that out.
Classic.
For whatever reason, my router refused to work that day, so I dug through my shelves for things. Oh, and I couldn't get into Steam because that broke. So for whatever reason, that's what I found, and I started playing because I'm a big fan of Quake 3. I've played through some of Quake 2, but I've never played Quake 1. Found the ultimate Quake patch, and that allowed me to up-res the game, put it in full screen size, and really turn up the graphics. That was awesome, and I also have really been anticipating Hawkins, so I just found out that it's online and it's free, so I went and started playing that. Unfortunately, actually, the user experience in that was broken, so I wasn't able to fully get into it. They kind of force you through a tutorial to learn, which I understand because they don't want newbies running around, but then after they did that, they threw me into a server list, and every time I tried to join, they told me I couldn't join because I was too low rank, even though I already felt like I completed the tutorial. And then when I wanted to go join a server that didn't have that, it said, "Hey, you can this server has, you know, players that are much higher than you. Do you still want to join?" And I'd say, "Okay." And then it asked me, then it'd tell me that I'm a noob and I can't join the server anyway. So
yeah, like, that's confusing. It should just like not show you the server, so it's not going to let you join.
It just, I guess even after you do the rank, you're supposed to somehow magically figure out that you have to go and do single-player missions to level up to some arbitrary amount. And after I figured that out, I played it for a while and kind of dropped it because I don't know how much I need to play single-player. First of all, that's silly because I came to play multiplayer. But I don't know how much I need to play single-player in order to get let into the online game. So there's a UX thing right there.
Yeah.
Man, like Hawken looks so gorgeous,
yes,
but I haven't played it since the last packs. Not this previous packs, but the one before that when it was like pre-release stuff. But yeah, I thought it was fun once you got into it. It was like a hectic. It was like just a regular standard first-person shooter, but you had all this customization in there. It's pretty neat.
Cool. What have you been playing, Brody?
I basically go to work, make games all day, come home, and then I usually work on my own stuff. So I've been playing tons of games, actually. But I haven't, like, the only thing that's really been keeping my attention has been Kerbal Space Program. And the reason I got into that was A, I'm a space nut, and B, it's the first sim game I've played that doesn't make itself inaccessible through the interface. You know, like making a game about space, you expect to see like a space shuttle cockpit, but the interface was very simple, the controls are very simple, and it just leaves you to worry about more important things like structural integrity of the rockets that you build or the lack thereof, or you know how to you know when you start attaching stages and making your gravity turn so you get into orbit. And it has so much depth to it, but it's very easy to get into after their tutorials. So that's been keeping my time. And then last week, Sega dropped Typing of the Dead, a new Typing of the Dead game.
Yeah, I saw you posted that on Facebook.
It's like,
I bought it like right away.
They started hinting at it, like, oh, we might have a Typing of the Dead game coming tomorrow. And we're like, oh, we're going to get a re-release of the first game. And then it's like, surprise, totally new game we've had in the works for a while. It's $10. Have fun.
Have you tried it much? I bought it, but I haven't even opened it yet. Or
I'm halfway through the game. It's all right. There's a lot of problems with it, but I don't want to get too deep into that. But I've been playing it partly because I really want to play those kinds of games, but also because of the current project I'm on that is kind of like a rebirth of that sort of genre. But I want to get into that either because we're very early in development of that, but I'm really excited for what that's turning into.
Very, very cool. Sounds awesome. So thank you guys very much for being on the show. You can find more about me at TobiahMarks.com. It's myname.com. Or follow me on Twitter at TobiahMarks. If you can remember my name, it's easy to find me. Where can we find more about your work, Stefan?
SoundHound is available on Android, iOS, Windows, mm-hmm. and BlackBerry. You can download it for free. It's a app that lets you identify any music around you. You can even sing and hum into it, and you can get live lyrics with your music. You can sing along.
Very cool. How about you, Brody? Where can we find more of your work?
So I work at WayForward, so wayforward.com. We've recently come out with DuckTales Remastered, and soon, actually, we also just came out with the regular show Mordecai and Rigby in 8-Bit Lands on the 3DS. And in the coming weeks, we're coming out with Adventure Time, Explore the Dungeon, because I don't know. And that's going to be on PC, 3DS, and all major consoles.
I just love that title, because I don't know.
Do you have to
So a little bit of behind-the-scenes stuff. When I first came in to the company and they showed me the design document, I was like, so this is just a working title, right? And the lead designer on that, Tom Hewlett, he said, well, it was going to be, and I just kind of wrote that down because I just ran out of ideas, and they loved it. So Cartoon nice. Network said, yeah, we love that. Just use that.
Nice.
What?
It totally fits the Adventure Time IP, so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
So it's called Explore the Dungeon because I don't know.
Very, very cool. If you want to find more of episodes of the show, of other topics, go to beindienow.com, BEINDIENOW.com. We have all the latest episodes there, information on where to find the show, people who are on the show, the links that we just mentioned. You can also follow the show on Twitter at BEINDIENOW. That's it for this week. Go out there and make some games.
Good to it.